My castaway this week is an actor. He's never been out of work since he left drama school 25 years ago. A familiar figure on television, in the theatre and in film, he was popular with producers and audiences alike for his ability to play character parts with distinction and care. And then he became a star, albeit in a most unlikely way, he thinks, as the reticent hero Mr. Darcy in the BBC's adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. All I did, he says, was put on a costume and act. But whatever he did, he's now a sex symbol as well as an actor. He played Renée Zellweger's lover, ironically called Mark Darcy, in the Bridget Jones films. And we can see him next in a Hollywood murder mystery called Where the Truth Lies. I've always been a chameleon, he says. The more problems a character has, the more I like it. He is Colin Firth. If it's problems you like, then, Colin, Vince Collins, the affable Englishman out front, but, a dark and mysterious character underneath. He was music to your ears when he came along, wasn't it?
Well, yes, and it was also an opportunity to play with the perception of me that I tend to carry around, which is the buttoned-up Englishman, well-educated, formerly charming sort of chap.
None of which you are.
Not at all. No. I'm a rather sort of ropey, shabby individual.
Yeah, but this guy, he's violent, he's sex-obsessed, he pops pills.
What you see on stage, because I'm a stage entertainer, is what you might expect to see, which is that educated Englishman. So when I walk off stage and beat people to pulp or behave in, with sexual excess and take too many drugs, then it's more
it's
of a shock.
The violent scene is particularly shocking. As you say, you've been on stage, you're one half of a duo, aren't you, in Hollywood in the 50s, and Kevin Bacon's the other half. You walk off stage with members of the audience, ostensibly because you're going to persuade him to help you with the act, and suddenly you're kind of beating his face into the ground. It's a real sit-up moment.
Yes, and a lot of people have asked me about the sex scenes in the film. And actually, I think it's more difficult, more upsetting in a way, to act violence than it is to act sex. It can leave you feeling a bit shaken. Whatever your approach to acting, that is an uncomfortable place to go. This is more than just a fight in this film. This is a rather psychotic bit of behaviour.
Indeed it is. We have never seen Colin Firth the psychotic, and we've never seen Colin Firth the kind of
sexually depraved.
Exactly. Yeah. But your argument presumably is that these are the kinds of roles you would always have relished. Darcy mania was just something that hijacked you along the way.
Yes, it was just another role at the time, and it was, if anything, a bit of a stretch. I'm not like Mr. Darcy, I'm much more animated, I talk too much, and I don't own the half of Derbyshire.
And your friends howled with laughter, apparently, the idea that you might be a kind of matinee idol.
Exactly, it was a big, big leap of imagination for everybody concerned.
Are you pleased that someone else has now taken on his mantle, Matthew McFadden, in the new film version?
I'm delighted, I've heard he's wonderful, and I am delighted that an extremely good actor has taken on.
Isn't there a tiny bit of you that feels a bit possessive about him at the end of the day?
Yes, there might be a tiny bit, but I think it's 11 years have now gone by since I did it, and I've heard enough about it, really. If I need any reassurance that I got it right on the day, then I think I've had it.
I'd like to promise I won't mention him again, but I can't. Record number one, tell me what it is.
This is Curtis Mayfield, we people who are darker than blue. There's something perennial about this man's voice that makes me feel that whatever's wrong in the world, there's a voice of simple humanity. And I just find it always very reassuring to listen to.
We people who are darker than blue, are we gonna stand around this town and let what others say come true? We're just good for nothing, they almost dig you. A voice grown up, shiftless chip. Now we can't hardly stand for that. Or is that really where it's at? We people who are darker than blue. This ain't no time for segregation. I'm talking about brown and yellow too. High yellow girl. If your mind could really see, you know your color is the same as me.
Curtis Mayfield and We People Who Are Darker Than Blue. You've never been out of work since drama school, Colin, and that's quite a claim. You have not come up the hard way. You didn't sort of tread it out on the boards of Weekly Rep. Do you feel, I sense there's a kind of guilt that you didn't do that.
There is an unease, yes. I mean, I was brought up with a lot of Protestant values. You're supposed to pay your dues somewhere, and, you know, perhaps your soul needs a bit of hardship in order to develop, so I do wonder when the catch has to come.
But tell me about, I mean, you always wanted to be an actor. I think you announced to your parents when you were 14 you were definitely going to be an actor, but you'd been acting. What was the first time you ever went on the stage and felt the buzz?
About 5 years old, pantomime, infant school is somewhere in Essex, and I was Jack Frost, and it was a pair of silver satin pants, a blue satin sash, and portentously a billowing white shirt.
Were you a hit?
I was. I don't know if I've been as big a hit since, and that's when I got the bug. That's where I thought, where the love and attention lies.
You remember recognising that at the time?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, there was nothing else that gave me that sort of praise, that level of approval.
Yes.
I didn't take kindly to being sent to school, to being sent into this rather cold environment where you're given lots of instructions and nobody loves you. You know, you're sort of on your own. I couldn't believe that I had to go back again the next day. I can remember that. I thought, my first day of school was over. Thank God that's over. Now I can get on with my childhood. And it was a horrible shock day too. Suddenly, the environment of school warmed up around me.
But you liked the idea of storytelling as well, didn't you? You liked the business of narrative.
It's been absolutely what's driven me through life, I think. Even if you write a diary of what you did that day, suddenly your day looks different because it has narrative form. It has a kind of ending to it.
It's quite childlike, that, in a sense, though, isn't it? That enjoyment, that suspension of disbelief.
It's entirely childlike, and I think that the skills an actor has to have are childlike. I think unless you have that, you can't do it.
But aren't you, as an actor, particularly doing movies, and particularly when you're a star, treated like a child, really? I mean, you're sort of told what time to come in the morning, and you're driven to work, and you're put in the...
Oh, in every last detail, almost. I mean, you are an infant.
But do you like that? Or do you find it deeply tiresome?
I think it's absolutely appalling, really, in the end. At 45, you realise there's something wrong with that. And thank God I've got kids, because you go home and the roles are reversed immediately. You can't say to your child, you behave yourself, or I'm going to call my agent. You know, suddenly you're the slave. And that does help. But I think a lot of actors I know, by the time they're reaching my age, are trying to take control in all sorts of ways.
We'll talk for more about that, but let's have record number two. What is it?
This is Fela Kuti, who is a bit of a hero of mine, really. And Nigeria has, even though I haven't been back since I was about four, has featured very largely in my life, partly because we've been surrounded by Nigerian people through so much of my childhood. And I don't know how to say the name of this song, because it's written in big capital letters. It's O-D-O-O, and I'm going to call it Odu.
Let us get down into another underground spiritual game. Abeg, after my paso-paso, you go dey help me end down with mwah, because them go hear mwah. Yeah. Nigerian government, them Nigerian military, Zala military government,
Nigerian military government,
Bolivia, them Nigerian military, Liberation Council,
Liberation Council,
for Liberia, them Nigerian military, Liberation Council.
Fela Kuti and Odu. So you spent some years in Nigeria. What was the family doing there?
My father's teaching at a secondary level school.
Your mother was a teacher as well?
Yes.
Actually. And your grandparents had been missionaries, so this is you were just peripatetic.
That's
all
right.
In the blood, huh?
Several generations. I even have a great-grandfather who was a missionary in India.
Mm.
And
again, not what we expect of you at all. We think, you know, you're sort of, as you say, middle class, well-heeled, restrained, public school product. You are none of these things.
Yes, I mean, I don't know quite where to put myself. I am those things to some extent. I mean, I have the lingo of the middle class suburban Englishman, I suppose.
But you didn't always, did you?
No, I didn't. And I've always felt a little bit rootless, and I suppose I've quite enjoyed feeling that way. I spent many years in North America. I have a son there, and I've never felt I particularly belong to a place.
So as a child you went to different places as well as Nigeria. You went to the States then, didn't you?
There was 1 year in school in America. It was an incredibly decisive year, a very important year. America absolutely blew me away. I was there from 12 to 13. Basically over that year we used the holiday periods, which are very long in America, the school holidays, to travel, and we got a Volkswagen camper bus as a family, and we just went west, north, back east again.
Mm. Great experience, as you say, and also, I mean, it mightn't have happened because the family was not well-heeled, as I was saying. It was quite a...
It was school teachers, and this wasn't based on having lots of money. This was a teacher's exchange, and we all flew out with other exchange teachers in a charter plane, and we hired an old Volkswagen bus, as I said, and we slept in it en route, and so this was not an expensive holiday.
But there was an educational purpose to it. I mean, your parents were obviously quite serious-minded in the way they approached you and your upbringing and those of your siblings.
Yes, they were extremely keen to expose us to those sorts of experiences and to open up the world to us and not just to be focused on one's own postal district.
Nevertheless, you were at school for that year in St. Louis, Missouri. You must have been a bit of an oddity.
Yes, that was a difficult time. I had one or two absolutely wonderful teachers there, but it was a bit of a harsh environment.
So how did they treat you?
Just very subtle, isolating behaviour, really. They were friends, and I think the actual teaching I got there was fantastic. But it only takes two or three people in your class, really, who, you know, were looking for a target.
But it didn't get that much better when you got back to this country, did it? You failed 11 plus. Let us make this statement. Colin failed 11 plus.
I failed 11 plus, and that determined the rest of my schooling. Yes.
So it's a tale of unremitting misery, this school.
No, and I really don't. I'm so sorry it's gone that way. Because that is absolutely not what I'm trying to do. And it was not that at all. I didn't like school. I just thought it was boring and mediocre, and nothing they taught me seemed to be of any interest at all.
Okay, number three.
Okay, this is Heart Attack and Vine. Tom Waits, this sort of began for me during student bedsit or student squat period, where one was quite happy to live in squalor, really. This is a period when I was homeless, not on the street, but on other people's floors, and you'd come home starving and try and find something in the fridge and it wouldn't be there, so you check behind the sofa, you know. And the lyrics are slightly incomprehensible, but they're satisfyingly kind of witty and rude.
Yeah.
Tom Waits and Heart Attack and Vine, and memories of Colin Firth of squatting in Chalk Farm. This is when you were at the Drama Centre there. This is where you blossomed, isn't it? I mean, all of a sudden you did want to know what was going on.
Absolutely. That's where I got my act together, really, to the immense relief of everybody around me. I suddenly wanted to do what was required of me.
You became cooperative instead of being perverse.
Yes, I wasn't trying to look for ways out of what I was doing anymore.
Parents must have been disappointed you didn't go to university then.
They were frightened because that's the route they knew. They weren't being snobbish about my desire to be an actor. I really believe that. I think they just were concerned about first member of the family ever going on that completely unknown route.
But it was the principal, wasn't it, of the Drama Centre, Christopher Fettes, who really had such confidence in you, I think from the off. I mean, let me embarrass you. Christopher Fettes has said since, it's very rare to have the privilege of training people for the theatre who are by nature poets, and Colin is.
Well,
did you know you were a poet?
No, I didn't. I hadn't heard that.
But he compared you to Paul Scofield, didn't he?
Did he?
Yes.
No, I don't know that either. That's a huge compliment. I played Paul Scofield's younger self once in a small film.
And you said you learned more from him than any other actor.
It turned everything around, seeing Paul Scofield. I watched a performance which made me reassess what acting was. It was nothing to do with demonstration. It was nothing to do with even anything that I was conscious of in body language. It was just an expression of integrity. And there was such a paradox in that, because acting by nature is false. So how can this man, by doing very little, exude truth and humanity and intelligence? I was so fascinated by that. It's basically the sort of thing I've tried to pursue ever since. And Christopher was very instrumental in taking us in that direction as well.
And in the end, he put on a production of Hamlet, didn't he, specially for you? A vehicle. Mr.
Yes, I don't believe it was a vehicle for me. What happened is he was engaged in a professional production of Hamlet, and he had to teach us as well, and I think it was more than he could do to do two.
But the result was you were snapped up, weren't you? I mean, the agents came, the casting directors came, you've been, as we said, employed ever since.
Yes, I was taken out of drama school quite quickly after that.
Kapow. That's wonderful.
Where are we? Now, this is a curio from Mozart's Mass in C minor. I discovered this around A-level time, and I was trying to revise for A-levels, and again, that resistance to the drudgery of schoolwork was upon me, and I don't know how this... It took me by surprise somewhere. I don't know if it was the radio, I don't know if one of my parents put it on, but I just came out of my school book and sort of felt profound and spiritual and floated out of the window with it, really. And I listen to it again now, and I still think it's absolutely beautiful.
Sylvia McNair singing part of the Kyrie from Mozart's C minor Mass with the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. The drama school believed, Colin, in the method technique of acting, the importance of creating characters who have interior lives and drawing on your own experiences. Tell me how that would apply to the character of Robert Lawrence, whom you portrayed in Tumbledown in 1987, BBC drama about Falklands War.
Well, that was the most extraordinary opportunity, in that the character that I was modelling myself on not only existed and was still alive, but was my exact age.
So he was on set, was he?
He was on set. I went and spent time with him at his house beforehand. And
because he'd been badly injured, hadn't he?
Robert was shot in the Falklands War, in the Battle of Tumbledown, on his 21st birthday. And he was shot in the head. It blew away a huge part of his brain. And he fought through, and his will and his courage were absolutely extraordinary. And a weird kind of merging took place while we were filming. Robert used to talk about the character as we. He used to look through the script and go, oh, scene 39, we're fit in this scene. And he said to me, and this is very, very poignant, that irrationally had come as a shock to him to realize that at the end of the film, he would still be paralyzed. Mm. I would jump out of my wheelchair at the end of the day shoot. And, you know, because I felt so connected to Robert, that was an irony that was not lost on me.
You stayed in touch.
We stayed in touch for a while, and I still feel a huge affection for him. I'd love, you know, if he's listening, get in touch.
You played towards the end of the 80s with Spoulon, hit Valmont in Milos Forman's film version of the callous seducer of that name in Les Liaisons Dangereuses. Of course, there was the John Malkovich and Glenn Close films, which arguably eclipsed yours, but no matter. The point about it is you could have used that as your Hollywood calling card, and you didn't, did you? I mean, your attitude to Hollywood seems to be ambivalent. Have you been frightened of it?
I don't know. Probably, yes. I did resist it, and I'm not sure whether that was just self-protection, hiding behind a kind of snobbery about it. I talked myself into the idea that it was a value judgment rather than something fear.
But in fact, you did something more than not go to Hollywood. You went off to the back end of British Columbia and became almost a recluse. This is because you'd had a child with Meg Tilly, your co-star. You had William.
That's right.
15 years ago? Were you 15?
Yeah.
I mean, I read that you were thinking of setting up drama workshops there. Were you really going to sort of go straight out of the mainstream? And
I have that tendency. I do like to withdraw from the fray. I wanted to
Take time out
and get away from the, you know, the noise and haste and get into another rhythm of life, really.
But the relationship didn't last anyway, and you did come back. What about Will, age 15? How much of him do you see?
Well, we're in as much contact as it's humanly possible to be with someone who lives so far away. I mean, we see each other frequently. It's every holiday and then all the time in between that I can manage. Yes, this is... I'm absolutely in love with this song. It's relatively recent. There's something very reassuring about miserable music sometimes, because it just means you can sit back and say you don't have to pretend everything's going for you and everything's all right and, you know, I've got it sussed. This is actually about the moment when you realise you haven't got anything sussed at all.
Yes, I realize it cut through bone to make it hard. Leave you alone, leave you here, wearing your wounds, waving your gun. Somebody new, baby, I'll love, baby, I'll love. There's too many people you used to know. They see you coming, they see you go. They know your secrets, and you know them. town is crazy. Nobody cares. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost.
That was Beck and Lost Cause. And Colin, you say you came across it in a gym when you were feeling melancholy. I want to ask you about the gym, because you said that when Mr. Darcy came along, you were 35, I think, let me quote you, you were embracing the pleasures of being a middle-aged oddity and joyfully getting fat. So the question is there a fat person in there trying to get out?
Yes, certainly is.
Is that?
Yes, and he's doing ever better as the days go on.
How hard do you work on him then?
I do get regular exercise now. You know, until I was about 30, I was one of those people that just stayed. I mean, I was so thin, I wouldn't even go to a swimming pool when I was about 20. But it seemed impossible to get fat. And now, yeah, I've got to go for a run if I want to stay this shape.
Well, he served you well, Mr. Darcy, didn't he? I suppose the question is, and it's the impossible question, is what parts wouldn't have come your way if you hadn't played him? How will we ever know? But I mean, you know, you did, in the wake of him, you did Nostromo, didn't you, on the television, and then you got Fever Pitch on the big screen, you played Vermeer, I mean, one could go on and on. It did change your career professionally.
It must have done, of course it did. Fever Pitch, certainly, I think, because I was sort of the moment at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bridget Jones thing opened up the possibilities in terms of film, and that, I don't even know if Bridget Jones had been written the way it was had it not been for Pride and Prejudice, you know.
Because of the ironic Mark Darcy.
Absolutely. There was something of the pastiche there.
But sending him up was absolutely the way to go.
That was irresistible. And in some ways, by embracing it, I feel like I leapfrogged over it in some way.
Are you going to do another Bridget Jones? Is there another one?
I really thought by doing the sequel, one thing I would achieve was that this question would go away, and of course it's never going to go away. I didn't even know until I came home and opened up the Independent and found out something about Bridget Jones's baby, that it was there was another series of episodes.
Can't let anybody take that, can you? Can't let anybody else play that. The father of Bridget's baby?
Well, I don't think it's me, though.
Oh.
Anyway, so I mean, I think, you know, I could well just be petulant about that and refuse to participate. But no, it was fun, and it's always nice to get with those people again. And I'm sure if somebody came up with an irresistible script, we'd make all the noises we want against it, but we'd all be back.
Point number six.
This goes back absolutely to what was extremely important to me in 1976. I was about 15. Free. Paul Rodgers, I still think, has the best voice of any white man I've ever heard. And Paul Kossoff was quite simply my guitar hero. And I would be sitting there in my math class developing my air guitar skills. So this is what I was hearing as I looked out of the window from that math class. The Steeler.
Running around, she's full on the corner.
was Spring and the Stealer. Unusually, Colin, you've said you consider the theatre easier than making films, which is not the received view among most British actors, is it? You know, this, you know, the boards are the purest form of acting. Not what you think.
I don't want to get into trouble with anybody here. It requires immense talent to do it brilliantly. And I haven't always done it brilliantly. So I could easily get caught out here. But I resist the idea that theatre is what it's all really about in terms of acting. I don't see why that is the case. And with theatre, you're in control of the territory on stage. You are going to do it in the sequence that the writer intended it to be done. And that's up to you to take command of that and shape it as it goes.
So you're suggesting because the films can be shot out of order, not chronologically.
Well, all right, yes, let's go that the other way. Films are not only shot out of sequence to the point which it absolutely, I mean, it mangles what you're trying to do. You shoot your wife at 9 o'clock, marry her at 11 o'clock, and you may or may not be looking at the other actor, who may or may not be in their full costume, in tiny little pieces. Now, I think that is a far greater test of one's ability to do what we were talking about earlier, which is to go back to that childish place where you can just believe. I'm standing on stage looking into the light.
Having said that, actors in general, whether in film or in the theatre, get bored, don't they? And we've seen a lot of the big stars turn to other things. You know, George Clooney produces, and Robert Redford and Clint Eastwood have directed, Emma Thompson writes, and Hugh Grant, I think, set up his own film company. What about you?
I am beginning to find the itch growing to go somewhere else.
What would you do? Would you write, direct, produce?
I'm toying with all of those things. But you probably have to throw away a wonderful opportunity and say, I'm not doing that, I'm going this way.
And that's frightening.
It's something that one is reluctant to do. And it's partly because my focus has turned family-wise a little bit at the moment, and you want to make sure everything's okay and your nest is fed a little bit, because I've got very small children just at the moment, and it's nice to feel that you can protect that. But, you know, got that now. It probably is time to start looking at other possibilities. I could have filled the whole list with songs that are to do with America and travelling and being on the road. Here it's the life that I would have had in a parallel universe. This is when I'm actually a gruff, tattooed American truck driver who's smuggling drugs and Mexicans across the border. This is Little Feet, it's Willie.
I've been warped by the rain, driven by the snow, I'm drunk and dirty, don't you know, and I'm still willing. And I was out on the road, late at night, I've seen my pretty Alice in every headlight, Alice, Dallas, Alice. And I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari, to Hatchapi to Tonopah, weed, white sand wine, and you show me a sign, I'll be willing to be moving. Been kicked by the wind, robbed by the sleet, had my head stoved in, but I'm still on my feet, and I'm still
That was Little Feet and Willin. So you have two more sons now, Colin, the ones you mentioned. Matteo, who's 2, and Luca, who's 4.
That's right.
Not surprisingly, their mother is Italian,
that's right.
His name. Are they bilingual?
Well, Matteo's not quite anything lingual just yet. But Luca is absolutely bilingual, yeah. I mean, he's... the rule is when you want to bring your children up bilingual that each parent speaks their own language to the child and sticks to that. And sometimes I just find myself using bits of Italian with him because he may have spoken it and he'll turn around and say, Daddy, you don't speak Italian.
Sweet. And do they live in Italy then?
No, they live, we basically live here. We spend a lot of time.
You come and go?
In Italy, but we're based here.
Mm. But Italy, presumably, you can find more anonymity there, can you? Or not?
No, I can't. Very much so. I like to have that option, absolutely.
You don't particularly want all those screaming hordes that once... I think, didn't I read they chased you from coast to coast in the States at one point, at the height of Darcy mania, waving their knickers in the air or whatever?
They must have been a long way behind me, because I didn't see them doing that.
Anonymity is guaranteed on the desert island, of course. Could you hack it? Forget about the family, that's it, I'm sorry. You know, you're on your own.
No, I couldn't. There's nothing about it that I could hack. I mean, I'd love to spend an afternoon there. I am basically an urban-minded person. So the desert island would be torture.
Off record.
So much of this developed around the period of my late teens, and this is Mahler's Symphony No. 3. I was sharing with another drama student, I was sharing a room, and he put this on, and I just found this voice absolutely haunting and mysterious. And he said, that's my mum. It's Maureen Forrester singing Nietzsche's Midnight Song from the fourth movement of Mahler's Third.
Of the fourth movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 3 in D minor, a setting of Nietzsche's Midnight Song from Also sprach Zarathustra, sung by Maureen Forrester with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Zubin Mehta. Colin, if you could now only take one of those instead of the 8, which you've had enough trouble with anyway.
I forgot about this question.
Yeah, no,
I think... If I can give a very prosaic reason, I think you get more for your money with a symphony or an orchestral movement. And so I think I'd be far less likely to tire of the Mass in C minor than I would of a single song here. So I think it would have to be that if I had to survive on one. Yeah.
What about your book? We give you the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible, as you know.
It strikes me, rather than as a luxury, almost as a form of torture, having one book. that you're doomed to go over and over and over again, but I think having been given the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, I'd be in great need of a bit of levity. One of the few things that ever really made me laugh out loud when I've read it is the stories of Woody Allen. And so I think I'd, if there's a compendium of all of them, that's what I'd take.
And a luxury we give you.
It would probably have to be my guitar, which, if I were on a desert island, would probably be an opportunity to learn to play the damn thing. And failing that, there's this wonderful thing about a guitar, is even if you can't play, you can hold it for hours.
And look good.
Yeah.
Colin Firth, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your desert island.
Thank you.